The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
When you turn on the evening news, do you see what you want to see or what you need to see? Welcome to Bread for the Journey, ordinary people doing extraordinary deeds with your host, Mariana Cacciatore. It seems like more often than not, the good news and people that are making it are buried into a two-minute feature piece near the end of the report. What about giving these people and this kind of news a full hour every week? Now, here's your host, Mariana Cacciatore.
Good morning. I'm very excited today because we've got a fabulous show planned. In fact, this is the first time I've ever done a two-part series. And the reason I'm doing it is because when I spoke to our guest, Francis Weller, I realized that the work he has done is very much in my wheelhouse. And more importantly, his book on grief is the best book I've ever read on the subject. In our initial conversation, he had so much to say that I could see that we actually needed two shows to be able to give you something truly valuable that you could use in your life to serve everyone you know and love, including yourself. Let me begin first, though, to tell you who Bread for the Journey is. As the show you well know is called Bread for the Journey Radio, Ordinary People Doing Extraordinary Deeds. And Bread for the Journey is a philanthropic organization and a training and education organization. Our vision is to nurture the seed of generosity in every human heart. And our work involves serving people who become volunteers with Bread for the Journey. We have 26 volunteer-run chapters in 26 cities around the country. And these chapter volunteers they become a board of directors for their local small charity that we help them start. And they give micro grants to people in their town who are doing things that make that community more vital. We give grants in the area of arts and education and environment and meeting basic needs and diversity, equity, justice. We serve children and adults and elders. And I serve as Bread for the Journey's executive director. And here at our central office, we give this cluster of volunteers in a city many things in order to do their jobs well. We give them nonprofit status with the IRS. We give them a beautiful website, training on how to run their chapters and training manuals that they can refer to regularly, both in paper and online. We host conferences. As I said, our vision is to nurture the seed of generosity in every human heart. And our mission is to find people who are passionate and excited about improving their community, and we work to help them make that happen. So if you have any interest in knowing more about Bread for the Journey, you can go to our website, breadforthejourney.org. And if you'd like to speak with me, you can type in on the Contact Us form, and I'll get back to you, and we'll have a deeper conversation about ways you might want to be involved. So before I came to work at Bread for the Journey, I founded and ran a grief center in Tucson, Arizona, that today is part of one of the largest and most effective social service agencies in Southern Arizona. I'm the author of a book called Being There for Someone in Grief, in which I guide people who would like to really be there for someone they love or care about who is grieving. And in the book, I help teach some basic principles and guidelines for what is required of you as a companion to someone in grief. And having worked in the field of grief and the field of philanthropy, I see a very vital connection between the two and have begun gathering materials for my next book, which will articulate the ways in which grief opens us to a much fuller experience of life if we would only let it. Grief has a paradoxical quality to it in that it's a huge subject, and yet there's a kind of simplicity to it in that the answers to the way through grief are known within each one of us. We all have within us everything we need to navigate the grief territory, except companionship. Grief creates a kind of level playing field in which we're all equals in need of one another. We cannot do this work alone. We live in a society in which isolation is becoming easier and more common. And in fact, we can enter into grief territory and remain isolated if we wish, but that's when things get into trouble. My guest today, Frances Weller, has written a book called Entering the Healing Ground, Grief, Ritual, and the Soul of the World, in which he not only writes eloquently and authentically and informatively about grief, but he writes about rituals he facilitates in which groups of people come to grieve together. And that may sound a little frightening at first, but I promise you that after reading his book or listening to this interview, you'll be wondering when and where the next ritual is planned so that you could consider attending it. So let me tell you a little bit about Frances. He's a psychotherapist, a writer, and soul activist who has, as I said, written this book called Entering the Healing Ground, Grief, Ritual, and the Soul of the World, in which he discusses creating pathways to reclaiming our indigenous soul, what psychologist Carl Jung called the unforgotten wisdom that resides in the heart of the psyche. A gifted therapist and teacher, he's been described as a jazz artist, improvising and moving fluidly in and out of deep emotional territories with groups and individuals, bringing imagination and attention to places often held with judgment and shame. He is currently completing his second book, A Trail on the Ground, Tracking the Ways of the Indigenous Soul. Welcome, Frances.
Thank you, Marianne. It's a real pleasure to be here today.
Good. For the first part of our interview, I thought we might spend some time laying the groundwork for a deeper discussion of the intricacies of grief and its capacity to open us to generosity and love. So that people have a foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In your book, you write this, quote, "For nearly 30 years, I have worked with individuals in my practice as a psychotherapist and in workshop settings. The one persistent emotion that has touched everyone is grief," unquote. So we often associate the word grief with a set of emotions we feel when someone has died. And I'd like you, first of all, to expand on that and speak about the many ways grief can enter our lives or, as you say, wash into our souls.
Well, I think you're right that the primary way grief is acknowledged in our culture is when we lose someone or something that we love. But grief has many other tributaries, many other ways that it does wash into the soul. And I talk about them in the book, about the five gates of grief. And the problem is that these other ways that grief touches us are rarely even acknowledged in our own life. So they become kind of a background fog, a background ache that accompanies us through our days, weighing us down. And so many people come into my practice and their primary complaint is depression, but typically what's underneath the depression is unresolved or unmetabolized sorrow. And just beginning to unpack those places of grief helps to allow the person then to move back into the fuller embrace of their life. But these other places, like the second, what I call the second gate of grief, has to do with those parts of our life that oftentimes were never loved or made welcome. Think about your own experience in your own families, in your educational systems, religious systems. We're told pretty clearly what is welcome and what is not. In my family, my anger was not welcomed. Even my exuberance was tampered down quite a bit. And so the message is that this part of me is not welcome. And I end up having to exclude pieces of who I am in order to fit into the familial or cultural expectations of what is approvable. Every time I excise a part of me, it's a loss, and the proper response to loss would be grief. But it's hard to grieve for something that we are also now holding with judgment or contempt. So this is a primary thing that comes into my office, is all the places that have been exiled and all the shame that accumulates around whatever has not been made welcome. And how we begin to heal those places is actually washing them with the tears of our grief, which becomes a very vulnerable, intimate moment of revelation when you can begin to turn back towards those parts of our soul life that have been pushed to the what we call the wasteland.
Right. Well, you explained that so eloquently, and I'm just reminded of the, you know, the times I've spent in therapy working with, you know, good therapists who slowly, I would have to say, create a loving space where those things become welcomed in the presence of another.
Uh-huh.
And then slowly I begin to reframe my own judgments around them or my own experience of them or unpack the way in which I hold them so that I can hold them in a new way.
Right.
Yeah. It's really beautifully said. Yeah. When you, in your book, you use the word soul quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought maybe we could begin, you know, as part of the laying this foundation, you could begin to talk about what you mean by soul so that we can use it in the rest of this interview and people have a context for it.
Good question. How I use soul isn't so much as a metaphysical or religious reality, but really from psyche's perspective. It is a more of a way of seeing than a thing itself. It's more a perspective on how you notice what is moving in the psyche. And you get the feeling of it, you know, like when you have a very intimate conversation with somebody, and you share those stories and those secrets and those parts of you that you seldom share with another person, we often call that a soulful conversation.
Mm-hmm.
What makes it soulful? Well, mm-hmm. Part of it is that we've gotten into the territory beneath the surface of our ordinary style. We drop into a range where we're willing to expose what is vulnerable. So we say that soul takes us to a territory underneath the social agreements where we talk about the things we seldom talk about. Soul is often found at the margins, at the edges of things, even culturally. We look at people of color, we look at the gay lesbian community. Those people who have been pushed to the margins are the ones embodying the most soulfulness in the culture.
Mm.
You don't find it in the strength and in the muscle and in the controlling aspects so much as you do find it in the weaker, more vulnerable parts of who we are.
Because they're forced to develop that in order to exist in the world in some way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's where we find soul in our own lives. We find it in the marginal places. We find it in the places that we either judge or reject or push to the edges. That's often where we find it. And frequently, our psyche takes us there, doesn't it? Through mm-hmm. symptoms, through mishaps in our life, through failures and defeat, through moments of illness. That's typically when we come to our knees. We go down into soul. The old phrase is that soul is a descent. we move down into soul. We find it in the low places. And so it brings us into what I call the commons of the soul, the things that all of us share as human beings. We all know loss. We all know defeat and failure. But we live in a heroic culture which says we should always be rising. We should always be succeeding. We should always be in control. We should always be successful. So part of what happens is that all those parts of us that don't match that go into this shadowed land.
Right.
And then soul ends up having to bring us there through some action of its own accord. Mm-hmm. I often say that no man has entered my practice voluntarily. He has come in because he's been defeated. Mm-hmm. Through a divorce, an illness, a depression, an addiction, something has knocked him off the horse. And that is a moment of grace. If that can be welcomed and attended to, not with an attitude of trying to get back on the horse, but to say, okay, what is it that's close to the ground that I have been neglecting?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And coming to accept the way things are, like that journey that begins to bring all of life into the light and acceptable. And you know, through some lens, even those places that take us down deep into the soul, welcomed.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's our deepest responsibility in terms of our own individual life, is to make welcome the entire range of our experience.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I often lead talking circles, and I find that in the space of those, that particular mode of coming together where everybody in the circle learns the art of deep presence, and one by one each person learns how it feels to be in a safe environment and to let those deeper things come to the surface. And I'm always so amazed by how we feel, not only while we're in circle, but afterwards and what's revealed. And I find that to be really beautiful soul work too.
Well, we're all waiting for that invitation, aren't we?
To
become transparent, another human being. And we are, again, living under that shadow of the heroic. We are so cautious and anxious about revealing this material, because on some level we fear that by revealing it, we will be exiled. We will be pushed out of the circle, when actually it's just the opposite.
Right.
That's actually our entryway into the circle.
Well, we need to take a break. This is already becoming a really rich conversation. So to our listening audience, please stay with us. We'll be back in just a few moments.
Save on your prescriptions with the RX Savings Plus drug discount card offered by Voice America. It is not insurance, and discounts are only available from participating pharmacies, but 9 out of 10 pharmacies participate nationwide. Everyone is eligible for RX Savings Plus. There's no age or income restrictions and no paperwork. Simply print a card and start saving on your prescriptions. Start saving today. Enroll and print your free card online at voiceamerica.rxsavingsplus.com or text the word TALK RADIO to 96362.
Adoption changes a family forever, for the adopters as well as the adoptees. There are many adjustments that need to be made, from lifestyle to financial, and the personal rewards are unlimited. Listen every week for Your Adoption Coach with Kelly Ellison. We will examine in detail such topics as international and domestic adoption. We will talk with adoption professionals and hear stories about real families adopting. If you've been thinking about adoption or recently began the process, you'll want to tune in to be inspired every Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific, on Voice America Variety. What sets apart VoiceAmerica.tv from the other video content providers on the internet?
choice, and flexibility means that you can host your video content live or on demand on the main VoiceAmerica.tv channels through your own branded media player or your own private TV channel. We support multiple media formats, so all of your video content can be in one place. We offer a number of advertising and video packages. For more information, visit VoiceAmerica.tv. If you think you've seen online TV like this before, let us surprise you.
Get the news on our shows and other happenings by following us on Twitter. Find us at VoiceAmericaTRN or Twitter.com/VoiceAmericaTRN.
You are tuned in to Bread for the Journey, Ordinary People Doing Extraordinary Deeds, with your host, Mariana Cacciatore. If you have a question or comment about the program, or have an idea for a person you would like featured on a future program, please send an email to bfjradio@gmail.com. That's bfjradio@gmail.com. And now, back to Bread for the Journey.
Welcome back, and we're here today talking about Francis Weller's new book, Entering the Healing Ground: Grief, Ritual, and the Soul of the World. Francis, you have written in your book, our capacity for distraction soon outweighed our capacity for attention and grief. Can we talk just a little bit about this capacity for distraction that we have in our culture today?
Well, I was writing that in reference to the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, and how initially, we were, in a sense, enraptured by what was happening. We were so drawn into it. But very quickly, we lost our attention, our capacity for attention. And what I think that's about is that so much of us end up facing that grief alone. And to keep our faces turned into that wind is almost impossible when we're doing it in solitude.
Mm-hmm.
So we are actually looking for distractions because we can't keep our attention at the heart of the sorrows of the world when we feel too alone with them. They become a weight that crushes our spirit. It crushes our will. It crushes our feeling of why bother.
Mm-hmm.
So we do. We are a culture of entertainment. We like to be distracted 24/7, and partly because we are also a culture saturated with grief. But we don't know how to attend to it, so we rely upon any means we can, whether it's shopping or television or just being online and checking every email and checking everything we can. There's a way in which our ability and our capacity to register the sorrows of the world or even of our own life is greatly diminished.
Yeah, I understand that. In truth, we need some distractions. We need to create this kind of balance so that we don't get weighed down. It's just, I see, so easy to move ourselves towards the place of playfulness and distraction because, of course, it's just more fun. Even if distraction sometimes is work, it is somehow more attractive than what we think is going to happen when we go into those dark places.
We talk about it in terms of not so much distraction, but the necessity of beauty and gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
That is what makes our capacity for facing grief more possible. Distraction, I don't know if it does that. I think...
Right. It distracts us.
It distracts us, exactly. I was working with a woman, and I think I tell the story in the book, where she was so, so distraught about the war in Iraq that had just broken out. And she was literally on the floor in my office sobbing about the depleted uranium, the number of children that were being killed, and just the horrors of it. And I let her cry for a long time and just... held presence for her. And then at one point, I kind of leaned down towards her, and I said, "Did you notice that the plum blossoms were out today?" And she kind of looked up at me, and she said, "No." And she said, "Well, did you notice that the mustard was in bloom?" She said, "No." I said, "Well, we can't possibly tolerate the horrors of Iraq and weapons of destruction without plum blossoms and mustard bloom."
Right.
That's what we're actually needing to do, is to keep some tension between grief and gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
To hold that. That's actually the sign of a mature human being, mm-hmm. is to recognize that they are both happening right now.
Mm-hmm.
Simultaneously,
right.
We are living in this gifting cosmos, this incredible, beautiful world. At the same time, moments of suffering are happening right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the tension we are being asked to hold.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm writing a bit about this journey from what I call grief to generosity to love. Because in my experience, what I see is that as we enter into this period of grief, sometimes it's a new and fresh grief that overcomes us and we have to be in it. We just do. And it takes us down. And yet, even in that, there are moments when the clouds clear and you actually see blue sky or the light comes through. And in that moment, what I often see is that generosity naturally occurs. We want to do something of a generous nature, even the smallest act, even if it's an act of generosity for ourselves, like reaching out to somebody or honoring a birthday or sending a card or making a call or planting flowers. There's this moment when generosity kind of is the right thing to do. And then we're back in the grief again. And if we can step back a moment and just notice that that has happened and somehow nurture that movement, then it happens again and again, where we're kind of consciously aware of that generous thing and how it completely filled our soul. Because it does. It when it happens, the sense of joy or happiness that you feel is so complete. It's as complete and full as the grief experience you just had. And what feels to me like happens is that there, when it is nurtured, there's kind of a new neural pathway that's formed. And in that grief, there's a compassion and an empathy and a humility that's born that you begin to see kind of naturally moves into a place of generosity. What can I do? How can I help? And when that road is traveled often enough, there's a way in which it kind of flips right into a place of love, where you have these of momentary experiences of a connection with all beings on the planet and a feeling of what it's like to be a flower in bloom, in a sense. It's just pure love. And when that happens, then our next impulse again is to really be generous. Out of love, we want to give something away, which in the grief, that compassion and empathy and humility that was born makes that generous movement move right into how can I be of service to somebody, and in a way feel a connection to their own, to that person's grief and sorrow. So it becomes this, I sort of describe it like a circle 8 on a horizontal plane.
Mm-hmm.
And with generosity in the middle, grief on the left, and love on the right. And it just kind of keeps moving through our lives. And if we're awake and aware to it, we can actually participate in the helping of that. And so we have a really fluid relationship and an honest and awake relationship to how grief opens us up to love.
Beautifully said. Beautifully said. I think that's absolutely true. I consider grief a threshold emotion. And if we can find enough support in order for us to actually fully engage that emotion, it has this ability to I call grief an amazing solvent. It can soften the hardest places in our lives, and in our stories. And so it does. It does have this capacity when we really welcome that difficult guest at the door. It does have this capacity to transmute all of the stories in the heart, and it does rejoin us back to the great story of the world. So I think generosity and joy and love are the absolute, they are the inevitable outcomes of a grief embraced.
That is beautifully said, the inevitable outcomes of a grief embraced. And I love that you said inevitable.
Oh, I think it's true. I think it's absolutely true. We just did a grief ritual down at Commonweal in Bolinas this past weekend. And people arrive on Friday night, strangers. I mean, some people knew each other, but, there's that kind of uneasy quiet in the room on Friday. And by Sunday, after the ritual's over, they're calling each other brother and sister. They're embracing. There's a feeling that we've joined this great commons together. And the generosity, the kindness that begins to be displayed, and the deep feelings of joy and infectious love are right there as a consequence of joining into that space together.
Mm-hmm.
Mutual willingness to reveal the heartache that we all carry leads to that place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of course it does.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this leads us right into a discussion about ritual. Maybe you can begin by just telling us what the ritual is, how you discovered it. Let's just begin at the beginning, lay the foundation for our listening audience.
The ritual we do has evolved over many, many years. My first exposure to ritual, which really wasn't even in my consciousness at the time, was through my association with an African teacher named Maladoma Somé. And I had taken a year-long training with him and his partner at the time, Sobhonfu. And what was being evoked by this training was this tremendous sorrow. That the training was called Ritual Village. So here I found myself back in a context of village, participating in all the things that on some level I expected but didn't get in my lifetime. And it evoked all of the untouched grief in my life around belonging and around participation in deeper structures of communal life. And so I learned in that time with them that the proper response or the most effective response to these common shared experiences is to go into ritual together. And ritual is really any gesture that we make, even individually or collectively, with whose intention it is to achieve a certain pitch, a certain engagement with that other world, with spirit, with the sacred, however you want to describe that. In other words, that ritual is a conversation between soul and the sacred. Mm-hmm. It isn't so much between human beings.
Mm-hmm.
We share that together. Mm-hmm. The conversation, the deepest conversation, is between my soul and that otherness, that mystery. And so when we do the rituals together, we take 3 days to get to it. The first 2 days are getting ourselves fully into the room. And we use a lot of writing practices for that and the group process so that we can begin to do what we call composting. We turn over the hard pan of our life, the ways that we've coped and adjusted and endured the sorrows of our life. And now we take them into the ritual on Sunday. And the ritual is simple but so beautiful. We create this lovely, beautiful shrine. And on the shrine, people place pictures of ancestors or loved ones, things they've lost. So the shrine becomes this place where it's like a concentrated soul-gathered spot of things that are deeply meaningful to the hearts and souls of each person there. And then we teach them a song that they sing with me drumming throughout the whole ritual. And people move back and forth down to the shrine, never alone. Every time you go down to the shrine, you're accompanied by someone who's there to witness your experience. And this is part of what's so healing, is that we finally are able to bring our grief out of privacy and out of isolation and bringing it back into the original context that our psyche expected in the first place.
Mm.
In other words, grief has never been private, ever, in our entire species history until now.
Interesting.
We even go into private practice to talk about our grief. You know, we go talk to a therapist about it, which is wonderful. But at the same time, what is being ached for is that larger welcome and that larger acknowledgement. So you go down to the shrine and you weep. You bring your grief to that altar. And then you come back. And every time you come back from the shrine, you are welcomed by the village. And they hug you and they say, "I saw you. Thank you for doing what you did. You did that for all of us." And it begins to put meaning and purpose back into our grief.
Mm-hmm.
It puts acknowledgement and appreciation back into our sorrow. I mean, mm-hmm. that is what we've been waiting for.
Mm-hmm.
Some confirmation that what I've gone through actually yields a meaning, mm-hmm. a deep purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time we've done that, we're all pretty tired.
Yeah.
And exhausted, but there's this, like I said, this infectious joy that begins to come through the whole room. We are lightened. We feel so connected to one another. And after the ritual's over, we just stop for a moment and sit in front of the shrine and acknowledge that where we're sitting right now is one of those places that is a concentrated holy ground. This is holy ground right here. As Oscar Wilde said, where there is sorrow, there is holy ground.
Mm.
So we're sitting there in holy ground together, and really acknowledging what we had just done.
Mm.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. And it's time for our second break. So to our listening audience, stay with us. We'll be back with Francis Weller in just a few minutes.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post on our wall your thoughts about our shows and network. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Family caregivers face some tough challenges every day in caring for a partner, parent, child, sibling, friend, neighbor, or even coworker. You are there to provide the care that these people need after everyone else has gone home. Family Caregivers Unite with Dr. Gordon Atherley will provide you with a social networking experience. You'll hear from experts and others who are experiencing the same things. And together, you will promote a common cause. Tune in to Family Caregivers Unite, live every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific, on Voice America Variety.
Take us on the go. It's even easier now. The Voice America Talk Radio Network has launched our mobile app for iPhone, Android, or BlackBerry. Visit the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market to download the app powered by Aircast. It's free and no registration is necessary. In minutes, you could be enjoying your favorite Voice America Talk Radio host, no matter where you are. In the car, out and about, while traveling, or anytime you can't be close to your computer. Catch up on the archives you've missed or discover new shows on the spot. Search Voice America at your favorite app store.
Why do most women who are actively dating have to know, "What will the future hold?" While for many types of guys, it just means, "What's going to happen tonight?" The Dating Revolution is a new kind of show about dating. It's not necessarily about finding Mr. Right. It's more about staying in control of what you want and having fun while dating. Your host, Heather Jones, is a casual dating expert and will provide the tips and tricks both women and men need to navigate the ever-changing world of dating. Tune in Wednesdays at 8 a.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. Eastern on Voice America Variety.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post on our wall your thoughts about our shows and network. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Thank you.
You are tuned in to Bread for the Journey, Ordinary People Doing Extraordinary Deeds, with your host, Mariana Cacciatore. If you have a question or comment about the program, or have an idea for a person you would like featured on a future program, please send an email to bfjradio@gmail.com. That's bfjradio@gmail.com. And now, back to Bread for the Journey.
Welcome back, and we're here talking about grief and ritual with Frances Weller, author of the book Entering the Healing Ground, Grief, Ritual, and the Soul of the World. So that was a very eloquent discussion or monologue about the work that you're doing in ritual, and I, for one, would like to know about your schedule of doing these rituals, where and when you do them, so that if I would like to attend, I can have that information. Can you tell us, Frances?
The schedule is found on our website, enteringthehealingground.com, and you just go to the events page. We do them several times a year, usually spring and fall, and we can also do them on request. So next year I'm going to be up in Canada and Southern California and various places leading them. And if people are interested in hosting a grief ritual, they can also talk to us about that. So we typically do them in spring as part of we call it the soul hygiene process. We do spring cleaning. And we have people coming, you know, year after year because of the value. I mean, if we were a sane culture and really, really tending to us, we would have grief rituals every month. When I was in Africa, there was a grief ritual happening someplace in the village almost every day where they were tending to the ongoing losses of community. The young men leaving the village, deaths in the village, that's just part of their maintenance practice. And I remember walking up to one woman saying, "You have so much joy." And she said, "That's because I cry a lot."
Mm-hmm, right.
How different that is from our perspective of what makes us joyful or happy.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a phrase you use in the book called soul maintenance.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And ritual being a big part of that.
Absolutely. I mean, if everything that matters to our lives requires maintenance, our relationships, our bodies, our communities, and we forget that our soul also requires maintenance. That involves that type of communal activity of ritual where we get to enter into states that we normally don't enter. That's part of the beauty of ritual, is that we get to go into territories that during our conventional lives we don't go into. We don't normally kneel side by side and grieve. That's a space set aside. We don't typically tell people about the deep angers, hurts, losses, and sorrows in our hearts. That requires a certain container and a certain context for those deeper parts of us to come out. And the last thing we need that ritual provides us is a certain time where we get to, I know this word is a little weird, but we get to be a little deranged.
Mm-hmm.
And I write about that in the book. And we are a culture that really clings to control. Mm-hmm. But there are times where we need to lose a little bit of that control, so what is buried and held deep in the bone has an opportunity to come out and actually be expressed. And we need to be deranged because the current arrangement typically isn't working.
Right.
And we need to be rearranged in a way that's closer to how the soul wants to embody this life.
Right.
And that's the beauty and the elegance of ritual.
You know, it makes me think about the times I have seen young children, you know, infants. I remember once somebody coming to me was a father, had an infant child, and their mother had just died. And this you know, this child, he wanted to know, you know, what to, maybe he was becoming a parent for the first time, didn't know what to do with this child. The child was crying all the time. And I said, I asked if he thought that this child loved her mother. And he said, absolutely. And so if she loved her mother so much, do you think that perhaps she could be really missing her? And he said, yeah. And as you miss your wife, do you cry? And he was like, yeah. So suddenly he reframed the whole picture of this child's crying. And but it actually took a minute, because she started crying while we were in session together. And he, the first thing he did was pick her up and begin patting her on the back kind of quickly. And I just said, watch yourself for a moment. Like, just imagine what it might feel like to her if you could actually hear her tears and let her go there. And it, you know, it completely reframed that for him. And I see so many people who, parents who quickly kind of quiet their children when they begin to cry. And, oh, my heart aches when I watch it.
Yes. Beautifully done. That was lovely. I remember reading that in your beautiful book, too.
Yeah, great
story.
Crying is such an important...
We are waiting for permission.
We are. We need to wail at times. We need to wail at times, yeah. So, in your book, you had referred to this already, these five gates of grief. You say that the first one is the most common, the other four less well-known. We won't get to all five of them today in this last segment of the show. In fact, we may only get to the first one, but this is part of why I knew we needed two shows. So let's begin with the first one, which is everything we love, we will lose. Do you want to just talk a little bit about this first gate of grief?
Isn't that a fierce truth?
Mm-hmm.
It is so hard to hear that. But everything we love, we will lose.
Yeah.
And this is the old teaching of impermanence in the Buddhist tradition, or Jesus saying the same thing. And we either try to diminish the pain of that by protecting our heart, or we agree with the rights of love, which is to enter into it fully and be willing to tolerate and engage the consequences of loving. And so everything we love, we will lose without exception, either through their disappearance or our own. And to stand in that fierce truth is really what matures us as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
There's a beautiful poem that came out of the 12th century that goes something like, 'tis a fearful thing to love what death can touch. To have, a dream to hold, and oh, to lose, a thing for fools, this love, but a holy thing to love what death can touch.
Mm-hmm.
For your life once lived in me, your words were a gift to me. Your laugh once lifted me. To remember this brings painful joy. It's a human thing, love. A holy thing, the love what death can touch.
Mm.
Isn't that extraordinary?
It is. It is. It is.
And that's part of what we're trying to remember, that by agreeing to love, we are agreeing to enter into loss simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
I remember giving a talk down in Carmel some years back, and there was a man in his late 70s in the room, and he asked a question at the end of it. He basically said, so tell me, what is the 1, 2, 3 of grief? I want to get over this. And it was kind of, you know, a tender moment because I had found out earlier in the night that his wife had died. Mm-hmm. But he couldn't quite approach those words, so he said a friend died. And so I finally said to him, I can't quite accept the premise of your question. I can't accept the premise of your question. It presupposes an ending to your grief. And I said, it will not end. It will turn. It will reshape itself into a bittersweet melancholy. But this is the new relationship you have with your wife. Mm. And he softened so much in that moment to begin to realize that he can't get rid of this, nor should he get rid of this. This is his new relationship to her. And this is his reminder that he chose to love. Mm. And it lingers in our hearts as this ache. But that's the gift of it as well, isn't it?
It is.
That our heart was willing to allow another to penetrate, to enter into and find a dwelling place there. And then when they leave, oh, that ache is my remembrance. It is my honoring of the fact that she or he became a part of my life. So this first gate is a very fierce one. It requires great courage and great willingness to keep asking for what we need in this place from others, particularly when we've lost something so precious to us.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is a risk, that we're willing to take in order to be in the world in a complete and full way, to fully experience the life we're living.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the deepest griefs we carry is a diminished sense of participation in our life.
Yeah. Yeah,
and particularly in the territory of love,
right?
That room rarely gets fully investigated,
right,
and fully entered. We are very cautious with our hearts.
Yeah.
And again, partly because we feel too alone with our feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, here we are at the end of our first show. I am so happy that we're going to have a second show to follow up on this. And my questions were in this next segment were actually to stay within the first gate and talk about illness. Mm. We don't have time to do it in this show, but we will open our next show from that place. And then use the rest of the show to talk about gates 2, 3, 4, and 5. I want to thank you so much for being so present in this interview, Francis, and to our listening audience. I hope you'll join us next week as we continue this very rich conversation.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. So, this is the end of our show. As you know, Bread for the Journey is a nonprofit organization, and it is one that could use your support. If you find a place in your heart to make a financial contribution, or if you'd like to start a chapter of Bread for the Journey in your town, or both, please go to our website, breadforthejourney.org. If we all pitch in a little bit, we can change the world. And I close today, as I do every show, with this. May all beings be happy. May all beings be safe. May all beings be free.
We hope our program inspired you this week. Please join Mariana Cacciatore for another edition of Bread for the Journey next Saturday at noon Eastern Time, 9 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.